Welcome to the School Sucks Project,
a podcast, YouTube channel, and an online community
dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives,
home education,
critical thinking,
peaceful parenting,
organization and productivity,
and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get
infographics,
comprehensive show notes,
relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at @SchoolSucksShow.
Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username @SchoolSucksPodcast.
And get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Because I spent most of my life in school until I talked to you first in 2017, so much of what I was expected to do in school did not prepare me to go out into the real world and run big fish. I have really been maxed and challenged in a way that, when you're in a factory model,
yeah,
there's so much that you just don't even think about.
There's right? So much autopilot, yeah.
Autopilot. And then we wonder why these kids are still in their, parents' houses and they have a hard time with initiative and they're afraid and they're anxious because they've been just anesthetized. The world.
Everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is Thursday, March 4th. And just this morning, I was fortunate to reconnect with Diane Murphy of Big Fish Learning Community in Dover, New Hampshire. We had our first discussion back in September 2017. It was just weeks before I left to go on the School Sucks Across America tour. We met in a bar. And we had just this amazing, fun, and lively conversation. It's linked in the show notes. It's episode 513 of School Sucks Podcast. And I thought, this morning we try to recreate it, that energy of a conversation in a noisy bar by packing in as many different topics and twists and turns as we could, having lots of stuff going on around us. I turned my washing machine on in the other room. Diane had piano movers at her house. I edited most of that part out. But we did it. We really created a kind of beautiful, organized chaos. And what I wanted, in addition to wanting to get some updates about what has transpired with this really innovative learning community in Dover, that's a really important alternative education model, especially over the past year. We're going to talk about all that. And the period of adjustment as we come up on the one-year anniversary of the entire world shutting down. What did that mean for a small nonprofit like Big Fish trying to serve the local community, but also extend itself out into the community and create opportunities, John Taylor Gatto style, everybody, for these teenagers to make meaningful connections with adults and mentors in the larger community. There are some links in the show notes, including to a TED Talk Diane mentions during our conversation. And if you want to jump right into exploring Big Fish, I know lots of people in this audience are in New Hampshire. It is bigfishnh.org. This is the fastest ever a podcast has gone from pre-production to release. This was prepped, recorded, edited, post-produced, and put out all on this day because I am going on a trip tomorrow to see my dear friends, Drew Sample and Nathan Frazier, who was just on the last show. And that last show is a lot different from this show, but that's how we do it here. So thank you so much for listening. Please remember, School Sucks is a listener-supported endeavor. If you want to help incentivize us in the creation of more content like this, you can go to patreon.com/schoolsucks, or you can go to schoolsucksproject.locals.com. Join our community there anyway. Doesn't cost money just to join the community. I'll see you there. All right, here's my conversation with Diane. Thank you for listening, and take care. You want to get right into it and just catch up on the show?
Oh, sure.
And just keep it light and loose and fun?
Well, it was really fun. It was a while ago, and I feel like... It feels like another lifetime ago. So this is good. I'm happy you were willing to talk to me again, because that was a really fun. That was almost like, for me, like the starting point that day we launched it.
It was late. Let's just say we've already started.
Okay, go for it.
So that was like the end of September 2017. Right. We were in Dover, New Hampshire. Do you remember that place we were at? Because we recorded in like a bar.
It was Seventh Settlement, which is a really cool place. Unfortunately, they're no longer in business. I don't know if they're brewing or what they're doing. Really creative owner. But anyway, yeah, it's a cool place. Dover was the Seventh Settlement of the New World in the New England.
Ah, oh, okay.
Yeah, so that's
so
cool.
The bigger picture that weekend was we were at the Free Coast Festival. One of the first things I saw when I got there was you giving the pitch to the whole group for Big Fish, which is still going strong.
We've had a few iterations, but yes.
Right. I'm obviously going to link people to that show. That was, I don't know, maybe it was, I don't know if I've ever done another show in a bar, but there was such a great energy that we had.
It was so fun. I re-listened to it like a year later, and I realized how rambling I was, but also like how super excited I was that I think, and I still am a little, and I'm a little crazy that way, but the rambling nature, and then funny at, you know, I'm in my mid 50s and I get diagnosed ADD, ADHD, like, and I'm like, well, most creative people are, so what? It's a coping thing.
Oh man, that could be its own whole show about these diagnoses.
Oh, I got a list of topics we could go on, but yeah, so that was we weren't open yet. We were just launching who we are, and that was so fun. Yeah.
Let's talk about, for people who haven't gone back and heard that show, what Big Fish is. So like your vision, and you were at the launch the last time we talked, and where are you now?
Yeah. Okay. And I'm giving you the cliff notes because 3.5 years is like poof. And it's yes, it started with, I had the opportunity to present to the Free Coast, which I was a new community to me. And then I ended up meeting a lot of people from there who were really interested and helpful. And some of them worked with us for a bit. So we started off, opened in January of 2018 with 5 kids. By May, we had 13. And we finished the season with 13, closed for the summer to renovate the space down across the hall, which had been a food pantry. My saint of a husband, a carpenter, he did all the heavy part. I was the schlep and the, you know, hold this. We gutted the whole place. I could actually show you some pictures. It was really great. We had some kids would come and do Dungeons and Dragons on Tuesdays, and in exchange for just loading the truck with debris. It's like, yeah. So, you know, a lot of this win-win.
Yeah.
Help each other out. So 13, we opened in September with 19 students, members. One of my first students who I had as a seventh grader in public school, she and I had this incredible opportunity to all in the summer of 2019, that next summer, we did a local TEDx talk. So you can link our TEDx talk. I wanted it to be called Who Decides? So basically it's called Is Individualized Education Possible? I think that's what they called it. But Diane Murphy, Maddie Person, I'm really proud of it. It was a pain in the ass to do, like
to put it together and all that.
Yes, the process was grueling because they're very, very specific about, you know, who's your audience, what's your message. They were great, but it was hard.
Oh, did they try to like impose any restrictions on you that you didn't expect, or give you any like really firm guidelines that you felt were? I've heard things.
Yeah, you know, okay, I'll give you one example. We had a coach who I think really, really adored Maddie, who wouldn't? She's this, you know, teen goddess, painter, artist, brilliant woman. And so her focus was on Maddie because they really wanted her. But then it was like Maddie's story wasn't a story unless you included me because I helped Maddie leave school. I wanted to say, you know, we need to stop wasting kids' time. They didn't like that. They didn't want me. They thought that we would have, and we did have, an audience of educators, 850 people at the Portsmouth Music Hall. And also, you know, they record it. And I love educators. I have been one my whole adult life. I love the schools when they do it right. They're lifelines for millions. But I just wanted to say,
For lots of kids who have no better option. Sure.
I don't want them to go away, but let's face it. They are so beyond broken. And we, you know, and this is where you feel free to help harness my ADD mind. But my point I want to make more than anything is that we have had this incredible opportunity in this past year, as we've really gone remote, most of us for most of the time, to really look through a different lens and say, what are we doing? I mean, our kids are beyond broken. Most of the kids who come, I mean, we have a diversity of population, but kids are leaving school because their souls are so insulted. You know what I'm saying? Like, they're not leaving school because they're lazy. They're not leaving school because they're disabled learners. They're leaving school because they are insulted by what is being asked of them. That's it.
What do you think that is specifically? Like, if you had to do outreach to, you know, a skeptical parent, like maybe somebody who's frustrated, mm-hmm. but they still just can't, you know, break through to that, what else is there kind of question? What is the insult? How would you explain
that? I usually start with parents by saying, what do you want for yourself? Like yeah. this, so Big Fish, we're a self-directed learning center. We help young kids leave school, or kids who are already homeschooling join us as well. And they lead, and we provide mentors. I have, whenever I question, like, it's been really hard, obviously, every business in America, every small business. I mean, we've almost tanked, you know, 4 or 5 times, and we keep getting these like, oh, we're going to stay open. And I think we're going to make it now, it looks like. And actually, ironically, we're going to make it because we received a student enrichment grant from the Department of Education in New Hampshire through the CARES Act. Mm-hmm. But because they do value what we do, it's just the people who value what we do cannot somehow help schools flex to do even, you know, more what we do, because people need freedom. So back to what we say to parents is, what do you want for yourself? And I'm really a student of, you know, I taught English language arts in 7th and 8th grade for 30 years. Right?
30 years. Yeah, right, yeah, right. That's right.
So that's who I am. I mean, when you think about it, you are, you know, people say you're not your job, but you know, no, when you're someone who reads poetry every day and, you know, shares Maya Angelou and Martin Luther King and, you know, Bring Me You're Tired, You're Weary. I mean, every year for my whole life, I've been doing literature with middle schoolers. Middle school is a gold mine of a think tank, you know? So with that said, we don't do it. We're hypocrites because the power and control, you know, the idea that kids have to even go to 4, 5, 6 subjects a day, the fact that they are, they just the coercive nature of everything we do. It's all about power and control, management, money, greed. And the one thing, did you read the book Sapiens or 21 Lessons?
I'm about 2/3 of the way through Sapiens. Sapiens is by Harari, right?
Yeah.
That is a very long-term project for me. I just kind of pick it up for fun once in a while. It's a really, really easy book to read.
But it's dense.
It's just as far as like the enjoy, like you want to keep going, you want to see. I'm wondering too, not to turn this into a book review, but I'd read it and I'd find myself really like immersed in like, what's this guy up to? You know, like trying to understand his whole angle.
Yeah.
But it's really, really well written. And it's a story that I love. And I'm always happy to hear, you know, some new person, whether I think we're like, you know, philosophically aligned or not, tell that story.
It's a good book. But the one piece that I can't remember, because 21 Lessons, his other book, I mm-hmm. read both over the last few years, and one with a 15-year-old who is a genius and just like read it in a week. And that's another story. But anyway, the comment he makes about capitalism, I thought, for me, it just like a light went off in my head, which is, it's the government and the corporations are the mother and the father.
Yeah.
I'm all about metaphors, of course, you know, and I think that's how we understand each other. But the idea that, yes, we are so polarized and, you know, all the social media that does that is, let's love each other as humans first. And let's help each other be better humans. So my idea for school is pretty radical, and it goes along with, you know, my guru, Ken Robinson and Ken Danford and all these great people, right? Is the idea that, why is it that a kid can't show up in a school building and the adults say, wow, look at you. What do you need? You're amazing. What do you like to do? Tell me what your talents are. What are your interests? What would you like to work on? We have the capability to do that. And, you know, I guess one of the things that I'm so mystified by our culture is, we don't have the right for healthcare. Like, if someone's ill and we don't take care of, but we force schooling on kids. Why don't we force health on people? Like mental health, physical health, all of that. That's where I get passionate about the work, because the kids who come to us, it doesn't even take like a week. As soon as they're free, I mean, and I'm not saying all of our kids who come to us are not in crisis or not, but many who come to us have been self-harming. They've had suicidal thoughts. They've been in therapy. They have psychiatrists. And now the good news is, we're starting to get local psychiatrists and therapists saying, check out Big Fish, because we're compassionate and we're non-coercive. And I think it's a no-brainer, Brett. Why can't, that's what makes people grow.
We might come at this from slightly different angles, and I'm happy to do little intermissions in Pumping Up Big Fish to have little debates along the way. But anything like non-coercive, people having freedom and autonomy, and you know, the huge part of my project, I mean, you know, the scene in the Seacoast and what the philosophy is there is no force, no coercion, and also realizing how, you know, force and coercion, I think, contribute to a lot of these problems, including mental health problems, that lack of freedom, that lack of autonomy from a very young age. And obviously, you know, we've seen the 333%, I think I saw yesterday, increase in self-harm since, you know, a lot of the coercive responses to the pandemic over the last year. I do agree that capitalism is kind of like a meaningless word right now. You mentioned that earlier. We sort of have this state corporate nexus that, you know, interestingly enough, has promoted a lot of that division over the last 3 or 4 or 5 years, and seemed to grow out of a response to a movement that I remember 9 or 10 years ago, where a bunch of dedicated people were going around saying, we are the 99%. You know, we are the 99%. And, you know, governments and corporations said, how can we make it like more 50-50 so they fight with each other, right? And we've seen the promotion of all these divisive issues. And you're right. I mean, that's not any kind of free market. And I've argued with, you know, free market evangelists as well about all of these wonders of the free market. To have intelligent consumers, you have to have an educated public. And we simply don't have that. That has to remain a consideration. That, you know, I don't know if you ever heard of Jeffrey Tucker, but he and I used to like playfully argue all the time, and he would talk about McDonald's as one of the wonders of capitalism. And I would say, is it? Right? Like, those are people who are going there every day. It's not to enjoy the wonders of capitalism, but even if they are, you know, that's not based on what I mean, I don't want to say things like properly educated, but making like healthy long-term choices is not something that for the average consumer in America, that's not taught anywhere.
Oh, critical thinking with action, right? So critical thinking, and that's the piece. When you come to Big Fish and we sit down and we say to you, all right, hey, your parents just sprung you. We're open 4 days a week from 9 to 4. Well, right now we're actually open. It's a little bit tricky because we're hybrid right now with the whole pandemic. But anyway, that's our basic plan. And, you know, so how do you want to use your time? Are you a person who needs to sleep in because you're, you know, a night owl? Are you a person who wants to work one-on-one with someone or needs other people to be creative? Like, I see what happened. So what I've watched from my very lucky, very privileged perch, I mean, let's face it, a public school teacher I was actually in Southern Maine. I made a good living. I had great working conditions. You know, I mean, I have nothing to complain about that way.
Beautiful York, Maine, right? It was York.
I was in York for a while. And then I was at the Southbrook Elliott School District.
Right.
So, and then York County Community College, which is another wonderful place. And they really do. They show up, and that's the community colleges do that. That's exactly what they do. What do you need? What do you have? You know?
Yeah.
But just this idea that we give kids a chance to have a little control in their lives, right? A little choice, not even a little, a lot. Now, what's funny is some of my free coaster friends who came on board, I wasn't free enough for a few people who really wanted to be a part of Big Fish. And it was really very, it was difficult. It was heart-wrenching in some respect for a couple people who I really loved, but we just...
When you say free enough, is that like in...
Yeah, free enough. I know, it's oxymoron, isn't it?
Well, what does that mean?
Yeah, so what it means is that our mission is to help kids transition out of school to like lead in their own lives. So the kids who were coming from people involved with Free Coast were already very liberated homeschoolers. They wanted to come and just play video games and have social connections and just, you know, get out art materials and just do whatever, which I think they should be able to do, but it just wasn't what we were trying to do. What we were trying to do is kind of make that transition from more of it's a learning center. So it wasn't a homeschool like playgroup, right?
Yeah.
But there were times for that. Like right now we have a virtual reality class going, and then there is common time, but it is almost like a library in a sense. And there is a gym in the building. It's not ours, but, and there, like, kids can come and go, but it's not a wrestling, come in your pajamas and play video games, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was just, it was a philosophical thing. And you do get like, so the deal we kind of came to after hashing it out was they can do whatever they want, but they can't prevent or encourage other people to not pursue their interests And what I tried to explain to one of our kids who was, he took the HiSET. I'm so happy for him. I haven't even talked to him yet. He's only 16 and he took the GED like a couple months ago, passed it. And now he's starting his business, moving to Florida with his dad.
Oh, wonderful.
So excited for him. He was an eighth grader who really was just so miserable, came to us for a year, spent this past year. Anyway, this is just, I tried to explain to him because he was collecting video game, you know, what do you call them? Early consoles, you know.
Like Atari and NES. Yeah.
So when he was bringing them in, it was really cool for a while. But he really kind of took over. But what I was trying to say to him is that a lot of these kids, they're not addicted to video games. It's just that it's been the only thing that gives them joy.
Yeah.
So they go home and they're just like, oh, you know, and I tell kids, don't feel bad about it. You've been doing something that brings you joy. So now do you decide if you want to make room for some other things? But it's such a habit and it's such a conditioning that if you go to Big Fish to meet, you know, somebody who's wants to teach you and play the stock market game or somebody who wants to, I don't know, wire a circuit or I don't know, do something like arrange flowers,
yeah.
You know, if somebody taps you on the shoulder and says, hey, let's go play Mario Kart, you know, you're going to go, yeah. And so there's that. It really was sort of a, you know, for me, I see it as just helping kids create different patterns. You know, the idea that what fires together wires together.
Yeah, yeah.
So when they come, so the one of the young man who was obsessed with, you know, collecting all the iterations of video games, really cool collection. I think he will open a business in Florida and have like a kind of an arcade, you know, pizza joint.
Yep.
So he understood when I explained that to him, but you know, kids are kids and they want to do what they want to do and they're friends, you know? And so it just kind of went a little wonky, ironically, right around the TED Talk. So we're getting all this praise and everything's wonky, but we worked it out and they kind of went and did their own thing.
Right. So one of the things that you said in our previous conversation that you hope to instill in young people is we are what we practice. You said that was like a really useful model for you. Now, shortly after we talked, I think within a few weeks, I left on a trip. I traveled all around the country. I went to the Circle School in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And I remember finding that to be such an interesting experience that this environment had been created where, yeah, some kids were going to go there and maybe pursue a lot of the same, or it's not really a pursuit. It's really kind of falling into the same patterns, right? Pursue is a action-oriented word. So right. There was, I remember my friend Tony and I went, and this is after all these years I spent tutoring where I was like another crummy adult as far as these kids were concerned, who's here to impose something on me. And then I had to like prove myself, you know, that I was worthy of their time and their space. And that was a pretty regular pattern that I encountered with teens because of the environment in which they interacted with adults in a so-called educational way. So I came in with two strikes against me. But I go to the Circle School in Harrisburg. There are these kids who come up and say, here's a new adult. What are you all about?
Exactly. That's our kids too.
Because they have, like the other thing we talked about is that sort of cooperative community, like adults are interesting, adults are helpful, setting up that kind of an environment by also expanding the school beyond its wall, or the center beyond its walls and into the community, which is something that we're going to have to talk about in the context of the last year too.
Right.
But, you know, also at the Circle School, I found that there was just a room of, you know, filled with kids playing video games and, you know, kind of like looking up at me coming in and clearly deciding that I wasn't as interesting as what they were immersed in.
Yeah, it's okay. They just were doing what they wanted to be doing.
Right. So you see that kind of pattern and habit everywhere. And I think that I'd started to like have lots of questions about unschooling if it was just this like sort of sustained inaction without any kind of a plan. And did you try to say, okay, well, this is what you like now, and obviously we're accepting of that, we're understanding of that, but where is it going? And maybe getting young people, especially if they're teens, and they can certainly engage in second order and third order thinking.
Oh, I actually feel really good about how we do it now. Like, so it's funny because, you know, when you, I actually feel like I've kind of grown up finally. Two things. So when we first started Big Fish, more than two things, you know me, I'll have 100 things. But anyway, we embrace unschooling, but at the same time, we help them make a path. Like, yeah. you know, you've got to have a vision for yourself. And maybe right now we have a few kids who just need to heal. They just need to heal.
Yeah.
We have a lot of empaths who come to Big Fish. Mm. And, you know, I'll sit down with parents and I'll say, listen, if you're a sensitive person and you're an introvert, the world is freaking on fire.
Yeah.
So leave them alone. Make them safe. Tell them you love them. Give them things to read. I have this beautiful young woman we've been working with. She's, oh my gosh, she's been with us we've only been open 3 years, a little over three. She's been with us two. She's 17. And she's been pretty much remote. A lot of anxiety. And she's healing. But she's doing things, you know, writing, drawing, working. I got her a math. We have a UNH intern this year who agreed to tutor her in math. Just one-on-one through Zoom, you know, just this gentle peace. It is a really strange time to be any age, but people need to try to go back. And this is probably why I am so sensitive. And I think being sensitive is actually an excellent thing to be. I'm tired of, you know, when I grew up in a house full of men, my childhood referred to as the locker room. My dad's nickname was Coach. I had three brothers, but you know, and it was always like, you're too sensitive. And it's like, no, you know what? I am spot on because how you feel matters. And I guess that's the piece with coercive education. And I heard someone on NPR recently with Harvard professor talking about the need for us to shift the focus from academics to mental health. I mean, duh, right? What was the stat you just threw out there? 330%. But what if we started with how people feel? Because you can't learn unless you feel okay.
I don't know if this came up in our last conversation, but I talked about working in a boarding school.
Right.
A lot of these kids had, you know, tremendous amount of emotional distress. They were survivors of various types of trauma related to abuse, related to drugs, related to the environments they grew up in, just, you know, the larger environments, inner city or even like rural places I mean, we're taking kids from Washington, D.C. We're taking kids from the sticks in Vermont, and they were having a lot of the same problems. And it was interesting. They chose to fight with each other about identity issues. I mean, this was 15, 16 years ago, but they were ahead of their time instead of like looking for opportunities where they actually could have connected, unless we could find them, right? Unless we could find those opportunities by giving them some kind of novel or challenging experience to share together, like putting kids on skis. This used to be part of my job. I was telling somebody about this last night, and I was kind of just remembering how like meaningful this was. And it was like some of the best work I felt like I did as an educator. We'd put kids on skis. We'd put kids in kayaks, and you know, they would come and they'd say, well, you know, I'm the baddest guy there is in East Providence, Rhode Island. And be like, all right, let's see how you do in this river. And there was almost like this cause and effect of this humbling experience that they would have. And then they would have to like connect with each other and work with each other, you know, as a team. But they also got this movement, you know, and it's not just movement of the body, which is such an important thing for mind and for memory, but freedom of movement in their mind, freedom to explore. And you know, that was one thing that I tried to deliver in the classroom, lessons that I had learned from being an outdoor educator, that, you know, just trying to do school with these kids was never, ever going to work. And having to break all the rules and then, you know, ask for – apologize if I needed to later, kind of ask for permission too. But I knew there I might have to deliver some apologies if it didn't go well.
This idea of kids needing to be out and move – I wanted to tell you how we managed COVID. I'm really proud of us. We've become better. So we were having a regular, you know, center Monday through Thursday, 9 to 4, kids come in. We didn't have a remote platform before COVID. And so when, you know, March 13th rolled around, we realized we were going to have to close the physical site. And we immediately developed a Slack, Big Fish on Slack. Mm-hmm. And we put all our classes on channels, and we have a common room, and we created places for kids to share animal pictures, and we have recipes. And I mean, it's just become this really interesting community on Slack, right? Which is similar to Discord, which is their world. And then we chose Slack because it's like, yeah, Discord, you can go and throw all the F-bombs you want and play your video games and then come to Slack and be a member of Big Fish, where you are integrated with people of different ages and you have a little bit more of a public interaction. Yeah. So I taught three of our mentors who are over the age of 70 to use Slack and Zoom. We had everybody kind of up and running, but it was a really obviously kind of a rocky and tenuous start in, you know, April, May, getting this off the ground, March, April, May. And what I learned from that, which I'm really grateful for now, because April was just probably the worst month last year for me. I actually ended up with learning that I had a tick-borne disease, not Lyme, but another one. Mm. So that was probably part of it. But I also realized what really hit me so hard in April was that I was not adept at Slack. I was not adept at Zoom. I'm not horrible with technology, but it's not been my focus. And so we were all feeling so insecure. Like, you know, nobody likes to be new at anything because it's awkward. You know, the first time you get in a harness and you rock climb, it's awkward. It's the first time you try to row, it's awkward. So I kept thinking, oh my God, why can't people understand that this is what teenagers are faced with and young children every day, is that so much is so new for them, like a sexual feeling or gender confusion, like they're bombarded with new. So we've got to get in tune with our own empathy. So what I'm also, we opened in September and socially distanced. You know, we wore masks, we had hand sanitizers, kids, people took their temperatures on the way in. We didn't do the plexiglass, but we were pretty conscious and we had room limits. So we only had 16 kids in September. So we went from our highest before COVID in February, March of last year, we were at 32 kids.
Yeah.
We were humming. Okay. And I want to brag about what some of our kids have been done in a minute, because we have incredible mentors who have shown up, and one of our kids is at Berklee College of Music.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, another one is at Pratt Institute in New York. And he graduated a year early from Portsmouth, from the virtual VLACs.
Oh, yep. Yep.
He graduated a year early and got into Pratt from working with us. I mean, big stuff like that. So we ended up deciding that after Thanksgiving that we would go remote because of all the travel and the spike in COVID. And so we went remote until just a couple of weeks ago. We started having 5 to 7 kids come in a day, socially distanced. So the problem is it's pretty much impossible to ask teenagers to socially distance. They're against their biology. I mean, it's against most of our biology, but especially teenagers, you know, they're in your face and I want to touch you. So we're still working with the socially distant part. And that's why instead of right now we have 24 kids. So we started with 16, we're up to 24. So we're going in the right direction. People are, you know, coming on board, but, so we call ourselves a hybrid. But what was really cool, speaking of outdoor educators, but we have 2 farms that we go out to. So while we were remote from Thanksgiving until recently, we would meet on Mondays and from 2 to 4:30, and Wednesdays from 2 to 4:30 at 2 different farms in the area.
Yeah.
And we would help the farmers, and then we would build a fire or go for a hike. There's one up by Oris Falls that is magical. It's beautiful cliffs and rock climbing and caves. And so we, you know, getting these kids outside, like you said, and building the fire is the tradition. The other farm we go to is a sheep farm, and they produce lamb for meat, and the babies are due any day now. And we've been working with them for over a year and a half. Our partnership, every Wednesday, they count on us. And we have 4 or 5 kids who are super dedicated to going over there. We move, you know, sheep fences as they're grazing. We weigh the sheep once a month with her. Now they're about 25 of them are ready to first. It's pretty cool. Like you said, there's something happens and it's not rocket science. It's called our species. We like to be outside.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We need to be outside and we need to be physical. So we encourage a lot of that. And that's been really fun. And I always run the outdoor stuff because I'm an outdoor person.
One of our biggest celebrations together in our previous discussion was about the community networking. Right. And this is one of the things that you've given an example with what we just talked about, but this is one of the biggest assets of a setting like Big Fish. And it's kind of in that spirit of John Taylor Gatto, a different kind of teacher, how he would put kids into these real world situations where they could actually experience success and failure, learn from failure, make meaning by being out there in the world. And like we talked about before, interacting with adults, so real world education and training. And one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about, and you can expand on what we've already covered in any way you want, is what the adaptation has looked like of that. Because, come this time last year, all of a sudden you can't be connecting people with adults in the community. So what was the re-strategization beside, you know, this is a great example that you've just given, but maybe there's some other examples as well.
Yeah, and we've been so lucky. And actually, I have the greatest staff. I mean, these people, you know, and this is a thing that when you say you are what you practice, and you know, I had been preaching. My mother told me before she passed, you should have been a preacher. And I thought, well, you know, I need to take into consideration all the things I've been kind of yakking about for 30 years, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it's been lovely to trust that if you put it out there and you ask with good intentions, that people will show up for you and people will want to be a part of what you're doing. So one really great connection that happened, and I think I told you, because of my, you know, I know I've like landed in this lucky spot where the first thing I did is I got out this giant piece of paper, put all the list of all the towns around the Seacoast area. And then I just listed all the people I've met over the course of my career who I knew would like what we're doing.
Yeah,
because I ran the theater program and I know most people I've met in my career like kids and they like learning. So a lot of our volunteers are people who I used to either teach with or former parents of students of mine. One of them is this wonderful woman, Katia, who I had both her kids. They're now 26 and 30 or no, that's, is that true? Something like that. Whatever. They're in their 23 and 26. But anyway, she's from Italy and has had to go back and forth to take care of her dying father. She's been splitting the time with her brother. And, she started working with two of our kids who want to learn to speak Italian, and she had to leave her job to go. She's actually on lockdown in Naples, Italy. Mm. And her time with these two kids weekly, sometimes twice a week, or just on Zoom, they do Zoom via Slack, is like a light of her life, right? You're in lockdown with your 90-year-old father in Naples, Italy. And she also came home to take care of some business, and they were, you know, had some normalish, they didn't meet in person since COVID. But what I'm saying is there's just been some wonderful connections that we wouldn't have had.
Because people have this buy-in, they're willing to be more flexible. And even if there's some friction or some obstacles, like, I don't know how to do this or I don't know how to do that. If it's just a bunch of people doing jobs without passion, it might be like, yeah, this whole COVID thing happened and now I'd have to learn how to like do a Zoom call and I don't want to do that. So let's just kind of cut that out. Right. But because you had built this network of people who were like really emotionally invested in what you're doing.
Oh my gosh. I mean, I'll tell you, let me list some of these incredible people who have showed up. We have the former fine arts director of Berwick Academy. We have a cartoonist for the New Yorker. We have the former head of the English department at UNH, who actually wrote me the most beautiful email I've ever received. He was at the TED Talk. He now runs a writing workshop. Mm-hmm. We have a young man who was a homeschooler who has his own tech company, works with us 2 or 3 hours a week. All we're looking for is people to give us like 2 to 3 hours a week max. I mean, even if you committed to like an hour or two a week, just think of what you could do with a youth who's interested in what you're doing, right?
Yeah.
We have, oh my God, the Soggy Po Boys. Do you know them? The Claxtons? Eric, no. He's amazing. He's been working with me since the very beginning. So it's just been, because people enjoy kids when kids are in their zone, right? I mean, when kids are feeling like life is decent, kids, they're really fun to work with. I want to also make sure before we, well, it's only 10:40. That's good. Because I want to talk about HB 20, New Hampshire state legislation. Do you know about HB 20?
I don't.
Oh, okay. So it would basically, in the nutshell, give families who want something different than school, something about like $3,000 to $5,000.
Yeah.
Kind of like the ESA. It's an ESA, basically.
So people would understand it as related to like a voucher where the money could be taken.
Sort of like that. Yeah. Okay. Yes. And so what, so anyway, of course, you know, I think you and I talked about this. I don't know. I don't like to think of myself as political. I'm a bleeding heart, however you want to put it, right? And then, of course, I have a lot of my friends who are in one, you know, on the left who are pretty angry with me for suggesting that this is a good thing. And I'm thinking,
what school choice?
That taking money away from the schools. And so it's so interesting because I did a testimony for the hearing a couple of weeks ago and brought two students with me to the Zoom call. We had 400 plus people on the Zoom call, New Hampshire State House Education Committee public hearing. And one of our kids read their testimony, which talked about mental health and wanting to end their life and how leaving school has helped them become more whole. Now, the other one was the young man who's doing Italian, and he wrote a testimony, and I can share both of these with you. They're brilliant. This one guy who I said is the genius who has that mind, you know, who just hungry mind and knows more than I'll ever know. I mean, he'll tell you, want to know about Russian history? Great. So he wrote a testimony. He's on the autism spectrum. And his testimony about why he needed to leave school probably will make you cry, because he just, you know, he talks about how schools don't understand people with autism and how humiliated and shamed he was and how, alienated from peers. And one of the things, he's been with us now a year and a half, and he's such a delight because he can reflect, and he'll say to me, and he's so smart. We co-teach the civics class, and I'll say, do you want to elaborate on that, Morgan? And he'll just take it to a whole nother level of detail.
Yeah.
It's so fun to watch because he's saying, so we're on the call. This is the piece I want to tell you about. We're on the Zoom call, and the different reps get to go first, which I think is crazy because aren't there like 375 or 400 reps?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So they let the reps go first at a public hearing. So we were on for like 2 hours and nobody's from the public. So I'm just like, hang in there, guys. And they're kind of multitasking and we're on our cell phones and on a Zoom call. So they're texting me. These people don't make any sense. You know, they're commenting about the different speakers who all were reps.
Yeah.
And they were just tearing apart, like, you know, that's illogical. That doesn't make sense. That's not true. You know, and kind of.
Can you think of any examples of that? Like things that really just kind of stuck out for them?
I think, well, a lot of the arguments were things that what would happen to kids, you know, that kids would lose, the schools would lose resources, kids would suffer, you know, and this whole fear mongering around what would happen if schools got less money and some people got freedom to do what they needed to, $3,000 to $5,000. You can do a lot with $3,000 to $5,000, like a computer, a tutor. And I wish I had more specifics, but it was just very surfacey debate, right? And then it was funny because then Frank Edelblue came on the call. He had a lot of meetings that day, and one of our kids, the one on the spectrum, and it was funny because I sent Frank an email later telling him this, is Frank went into in depth about why this could work and how we need, you know, this educational ecosystem. Because schools aren't flexing, and I want to help them flex, but they don't want to play with us. I mean, maybe Dover will.
So the counter argument, just so we
go ahead and fill in, the background.
Yeah, if you're dealing with somebody who's being supportive of the public school, I might be more of a cynic when it comes to all of this legislation and the debate around legislation. And it makes me sad to think about young people putting all this effort into, you know, something that has to do with educational policy, while, you know, some rep in this state or any other state has to like feign polite listening while the unions have already made their decisions for them.
Oh, I know.
So
I know.
In this case, I think a good counter argument to make for somebody who's saying schools are going to lose resources is like, look, you just have to think a little bit more long term. If you're interested in actually saving the schools, which is certainly not near the top of my priority, I mean, we differ in priorities there, and that's fine. But what would make the schools better than, you know, expanding that educational ecosystem, people seeing more options, seeing the directions that people and dollars go. And then that is just like the most hard and fast concrete, like, evidence of what do people want. And then, I mean, I guess there's always the escape hatch of like, people don't know what they want. These are just ordinary people. They don't have our expertise.
Right.
But obviously, and we talked about this, this was the point we were making about, you know, you need to be happy. You need to feel good to learn. And that was why I entered that story about the school that I used to work at. We would get so much more out of people by putting them, and I don't even want to say that, they would get more out of themselves.
Yes, there you go. Environment is everything.
Environment is everything. So by just taking them out of that building made a huge, huge difference. And and putting them in a place where they could, you know, over some time, experience success and experience some freedom, then they would be more of a footing to like do something that they thought was meaningful and valuable intellectually. You know, that's how that had to work from my experience as an educator.
So I guess I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you would support schools if. And I guess the word school is such a trigger word for a lot of people.
Yeah.
We have these large facilities, right? I mean, they just built one in Dover. I don't know if you saw it before you moved away, but it's $85 million career tech center, high school, like gorgeous, you know, facility. What if the entire thing became what, and this isn't me inventing, this is what Ken Robinson talked about. And this is what Gatto talked about. Is, you know, and somebody, Safe Learning Opportunity Centers. Have you heard that acronym? SLOCs? I don't know. There was an article in the New York Times, I think SLOCs. Safe Learning Opportunity Centers, not a great acronym. I hate acronyms anyway.
Yeah.
But the idea that what if, and this is where, you know, I've always loved to be a dreamer, so I'm going to keep going. You have this $85 million beautiful facility, and it's run on a learning center model. where people actually sign up for things. And so people who go to school or SLOCs or whatever, what, you know, you wouldn't mind spending this, these millions of dollars, because it would be a place where kids wanted to go, because they were getting mentored and because they were making choices, and maybe they were going 2 days a week, or maybe they were only going in the morning. Like, you know, that whole idea of access, and it just doesn't, like, the coercive factory model thing is killing our kids, and that we're doing it. And then the thing that makes me crazy, and I was a union member for 30 years, and I'm just like, it's the unions that are preventing us. Not just the unions, and I believe in unions to a certain degree, but don't prevent us from making progress when a factory model school pushing kids, sorting them by, first of all, the fact that you're sorting kids by age is crippling. I was a very mature kid, and I was crippled by, until I got to high school, I was like, oh, good, some people I can have a, and Morgan felt, we talked about that recently. He's so sophisticated. He thought he couldn't connect with his peer group. So you know what I'm saying? Like, could you support a different, you know, I mean, again, I think we could do this. We could shift the purpose, you know, the sort of structure of school. We have the infrastructure of all these things, right?
I would have to know more about how this new model breaks free of the current broken incentive structure, right?
Right.
Because what are the incentives to succeed? It's kind of like, you know, I'm watching these stories about kids are going back to school. Right. And teachers are staying home, and schools at taxpayer expense are hiring what they call classroom monitors to come in and basically turn on. So they're paying, you know, this one school in Fairfax County, Virginia is paying 800 people to do, or maybe it's a district. I'm sorry. Maybe it's a district. Paying 800 people to go in and turn on Zoom meetings and then sit there with a class.
Yeah. It's babysitting.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's right.
So many of the things that have, I think, just been laid bare for parents over the last year about the broken incentive structure in schools. I mean, I don't see how the public system addresses that. And I have no fantasies about the public system going away.
Yeah, there's so, see, and this is where I get into trouble, right? Because it's one thing to be a dreamer, and then it's one thing to put it to action. So like the piece I feel like we're doing with Big Fish, you know, I'm one person, but we are staff, you know, and we are, my board of directors is amazing. I got a new board director, the young woman who went to Berkeley, the student. Her mom was so grateful. She stepped up. She's a, has an insurance company, long time, L&K Insurance. And she really became our board chair about less than a month before COVID hit.
Yeah.
If that wasn't like divine intervention, we would have been tanked. I mean, she totally has, she and our business manager, they've just really made it happen for us. But so I guess, you know, I got to have a little humility here, which is that I just want us at Big Fish to hold a model for what's possible. And it's not necessarily for every kid, you know, like some, that's some kids love. And I want that traditional model to be available too, because some people, you know, and there needs to be like 100 say opportunity, you know, or infinite possibilities. If you could kind of do like a community college, you know, framework where you show up and you go, hey, how are you going to use your time? You know, I don't know. And again, it's easier said than done. I respect people who are trying to work on policy, but the political football that was getting passed back and forth for 4.5 hours was just like, they're just locked. Oh, this school choice, they're just trying to undermine and, you know, defund public education. And, oh, you conservatives, you know, whatever. It was just sort of that kind of nastiness. And I'm like, listen, stop it. Our kids are hurting.
Yeah. And that's the thing that, and like I said, maybe that's cynicism, but in any kind of proceeding like that, I just see an 100% absence of sincerity where people have agendas, people have talking points, and very, very rarely is the question of what's actually best for our kids. You know, it's very much a heuristic, and I don't think it paints a fair picture of all, you know, professionals. But, you know, Albert Shanker, who was a very powerful teachers union figure, said in the 1970s, when kids start paying union dues, that's when I'll start representing the interests of school children. You know, now, whether he actually said that or not, and whether that's representative of 25, 50% of the attitudes of the actual mostly well-intentioned people who go to work in these buildings, that is a revealing statement about the incentive structure in the schools. And as far as like solutions are concerned, I have for almost 12 years now stayed away from anything that sounds like a collective solution, right? That's one of the things that I love about what you're doing is it's like, maybe we'll bring together 30 or 40 kids and we'll try this model. And maybe there'll be another model across town that does something different. It's kind of like, you know, you talk about people breaking away. And then, you do have to play a bit of a game where you can go to people who are like, no, public school system's fine. I don't want resources taken away from public schools for whatever reason. And maybe, at the end of the day, for some people, the reason is actual sincerity. Like, they really are true believers about, like, this is the best way to do it. Then you could say, well, here's a case study or a comparative case study of five case studies, five different learning centers that do things different ways and got these results and attracted these kinds of kids with these kinds of goals. And you're giving people this transitional step to a more personalized, self-directed education, because you called it before a hybrid, right? It's not home. It's not a school. It's something in between. It's a bridge between the two that takes us to the future, you know? So being able to set these up not only gives more information about getting away from that question of how to put education into people, but teaching them more about how to educate themselves. And through a better understanding, it's like, if people want the public school system to survive, here is a kind of stress test that could make it better in the long run if people would just engage in some longer term thinking about what's best for schools, what's best for teachers, and what's best, most importantly, for students.
Right. And so we have had, it's been interesting. Have you heard of the Acton Academies?
Love the Acton Academies. I have this guy, Matt Boudreau, who runs an Acton Academy out in Placer County, California. He's been on the show a couple of times.
So one of those opened just down the street from us.
Love it. That's awesome.
Yeah. And it's fine. And one of our members, his brother goes to Acton and he comes to us. And, it's a different thing. You know, they do their quests. It's more directed.
Hero's journey.
Hero's journey. Right. And you know, we have some of that in our role playing, but it's not a self-directed learning center. So it's another thing that could work for other kids. And Dover's been kind of cool with, people have been creative with the pandemic. There's a little group of 5 to 10 year olds. They call themselves Wild Tides. And they created this little pod school in a garage, a heated garage. But, you know, I think that's the point is, that's the educational ecosystem thing. And I'm not threatened by the Acton Academies because we're a different thing, you know, and I'm not threatened by anybody who's a free coaster who wants to do a completely unschooling makerspace or have at it space, because that's a different thing. So there's room for all of us, you know, and I guess for me, I get excited and I know I need to stay in my lane, you know, but the other thing I wanted to say about school was, because I spent most of my life in school until I talked to you first in 2017, so much of what I was expected to do in school did not prepare me to go out into the real world and run big fish. I have really been maxed and challenged in a way that, you know, you got to make your own schedule. You got to drive places. You got to, you know, when you're in a factory model, there's so much that you just don't even think about.
There's so much autopilot.
Autopilot. And then we wonder why these kids are still in their, you know, parents' houses and they have a hard time with initiative and they're afraid and they're anxious because they've been just anesthetized. So that's the piece that you see it. And we know in order to get a better, you know, a more educated, happier, healthier citizenry, we've got to help our young people harness their talents. You know, we have a young girl who came out in fifth grade because she was bullied. She's also these kids were mildly on the spectrum. They are gifts. They are gifts to us. Mm-hmm. Even if kids were severely on the spectrum, every human is a gift to us. But the kids who come to Big Fish, this one young girl has a guinea pig business. She sells to a local pet shop. She makes a lot of money selling guinea pigs and breeding them.
Well, just to insert my own philosophy of liberty into the schooling conversation, I was listening to a friend on his podcast recently, and he just kind of mused this question, like, how many, if you add up all the hours that people spend waiting in U.S. Customs office for, you know, questionable, non-essential kind of bureaucratic things, how many lifetimes are spent? You know, how many lifetimes are spent a year just by people who are locked into these inhuman, supposedly efficient bureaucratic procedures, because of that autopilot, there is no invitation or acceptance of problem solving. Or it's kind of like something I like to say, like if I have a problem at the post office or, you know, this is in private business as well. You're dealing with a customer service person. They go, sorry, man, computer can't do anything. Right. Sorry, computer. I mean, that's a schooled mindset, right? And whether you're a student or you're a teacher or you're an administrator, that autopilot, I think, has a real, real cost to society because that is not putting people in a place where they go, here's a problem. Let's put our minds together and come up with some kind of solution. It's like, sorry, man, can't do that.
Right.
Can't
they don't participate.
That.
They're not participating.
Right.
Right. And then you get apathy. Right. And the other part is that people, you know, communicating in memes, people don't read depth, you know, in general, it's this diversion and, you know, we could get existential about it, but you have to wonder like why the corporation and the government, the mother and the father, why do they keep us? Why do we keep people so limited?
we can certainly come up with some answers to that, right?
Yeah. And it's unfortunate, you know, and we look at trying to, you know, we take one of our things, part of our mission, and thanks to Ken Danford and Liberated Learners. I mean, I'll email you a couple of links that I'd love for you to
share with us
because I have been so lucky. We meet on Zoom, the directors from Liberated Learners. You don't show up every week, but there's an opportunity to connect every other Tuesday night. I'm just so grateful for these people. They're all over the world now. There's a wonderful center in Manila, the Philippines. We have a new center in LA, Texas. There's one. They're just some great people doing really good work, but it's everyone thinks, oh, you guys should be hopping, but we're not. We're all struggling to stay open because everybody's hibernating. And, you know, with the pandemic and all the uncertainty in the country, people are thinking, I don't want to try something new. Leaving school feels like, you know, too unsafe right now. I think in the long haul, people will start coming out and joining these things. I think right now we're in that hibernation mode.
So I have one last question before we wrap up today. We talked just in our back and forth before we recorded about missed opportunities for schools during COVID.
Oh, yeah.
Now, we are approaching on my show the 1 year anniversary of me first saying that this is a golden age of opportunity for alternative education.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I have encouraged, I mean, I think people in my audience do this anyway, but to look for opportunities for outreach with people who maybe for the first time have come off that autopilot as students, as parents, as teachers, even maybe public school administrators who are going like, how long are we going to do this? What we're doing and who can't ignore the emotional costs to young people, whether they're stuck at home in front of their computer on Zoom all the time, right? Isolated, like a lot of kids have been. And I understand like this is changing now, or they're in these places where, you know, we have back-to-back presidents of the United States who say top priority is schools reopening. Top priority is schools reopening. So important to get schools reopening. And parents are just clamoring like, you know, because the school is in many ways, you know, I know it's really pejorative to call it a babysitting service, but parents, it functions that way for, you know, a two income family, which is kind of a necessity in the United States over the last, you know, 30 or 40 years. So the school is an essential part of the so-called functioning of society. So parents really need these places open. And that hands all of the bargaining power to the administrators and the departments of education to go, oh, you want us to be open? Well, here's what your kids are going to have to do. Mm. And it's even, you know, more of these, like what is almost like gaslighting.
Well, right. So you get to go schools. This has been, we talked about this at the director's meeting, Liberated Learners, a couple weeks ago, because we're like, it's such a weird time. There's this, get those kids back to school, right? And we have this very romantic relationship with school in our culture. It's in our movies. It's in our stories, right? It's where you fell in love. It's where you got whatever. You know, I mean, and for some people, it is that, you know, that Americana, you know, apple pie. But when I said that, I thought the same thing. And you know, ironically, one of my favorite people who I've met in the last 3.5-4 years is the school superintendent of Dover, Bill Harbron. He has become a bit of a mentor, really. He shares a lot of leadership things with me, and I've had great conversations with him, and he would really like to just bring us in the fold. He loves what we're doing. We're in the same building. But I've listened to his challenges around the pandemic, and before the pandemic, the year before that, there was a huge racial incident that was horrible. And, you know, it's just this, the problem is the system is all tied up and meshed in bureaucracy. And it's just, maybe it's too, you know, I don't want to you don't want to burn it all down, but you kind of got to gut it. You got to, what are you doing? Right. And I, maybe you do take it, but I guess with what I've watched with Bill Harborn, who I believe philosophically, he and I share a lot. I mean, he definitely a little bit older and a little bit more rules oriented, but at the same time, I see that his hands are tied in so many things he'd like to do. He can't, because of the union, because of the town, because of the school board, because of the legislation, the laws. I mean, New Hampshire has made some weird things that I've, you know, that's the other thing. Cause I've taught in Maine. I've learned a lot about New Hampshire in the last few years, but I mean, they raised the age for kids to take the GED. Like,
really?
Yeah. This was before me. So like, I don't know, like 6 or 8 years ago. So you have to be like 18. And if you want to do it when you're younger, you have to get all these permissions and yada, yada. I mean, there's this, they make obstacles. But what I think they don't understand is that if they showed up for kids in a more organic way and get out a lot of the BS, right? And do, and I say we're holding the model because it's not rocket science. Showing up for people is not rocket science.
Right.
And we have, I mean, with the billions of dollars being spent, you know, yes. Okay. So when the pandemic started, I thought the same thing. Families need babysitters. Why don't we call it what it is? We got that $85 million building, divide it up and get. But you know what? What you're going to send kids back to classrooms where they're going to like sit in a metal desk and not be able to like,
yeah.
To me, when I see those pictures of kids sitting like 6-8 feet apart and they're, you know, and they're masked, of course. And
it's theatrical. If I could just add this, it is really like photo op theatrical kind of stuff. And I mean, we've seen this in various forms in our society when you get to that, like, cover your own butt bureaucratic thinking. Mm-hmm. So why does a 7-year-old that you bring to the airport have to take his shoes off in 2021? Because maybe a guy in 2004 tried to light his shoe on fire on a plane. Right. So now we have this whole performance that we do that, you know, we all pretend that this makes us safer somehow. And I've really seen in this age of programming people more with pictures and performances, you know, you talked about memes and I think memes go both ways. You know, they have utility, but it's a question that I've asked over the last year, you know, too. And I'm sure you have thoughts on this as a former English teacher. Is it newspeak, right? Is it reducing the language? But that performance that we see from, you know, schools is like, look at how we put your kid in a bubble and look at these things we made to wear over their face while they play their trombone in band with a little slit for them, you know, to like, this is nonsense, right? But it's a kind of, it's almost like people trying to out theater each other in these visuals that supposedly represent care and safety. When it just like when you put it all together and you look at the big picture, it just looks like a society gone insane.
It's a circus. Yeah. So the big problem, I think, for us is how do we manage the masses? You know, mm-hmm. I mean, what if you are a school in Chicago, you're a school in New York City? I mean, managing it's. And again, I think we have the technology. We have people now have more free time than they used to. If you think about it, I mean, I certainly have more. I remember my grandmother who never stopped, you know, because that was just the times. But you can, what I'm saying is people have time to mentor. So instead of, that's the shift I'd like to see happen is we actually should say, what are our needs? Okay. Yeah. This, you know, check the box. We need daycare. We need supervision for our kids from this time to this time. You know, my kid needs physical activity. My kid needs to be outdoors. You know, my kid needs creativity, needs art supplies, you know, whatever it is, like there should be opportunities for parents with their kids to design kind of that. I said this years ago, like every kid should have their own individual plan. Like why not?
Right. Yeah. Why and there's a lot of window dressing there too. I mean, I used to write IEPs. I think we talked about this before. You're copying and pasting standards into this IEP. Yeah. So you're not truly writing an authentic individualized education plan for a person. At least that's how it was. For me 20 years ago. I'm sure it's worse now.
Well, you know? I don't play the standards game at all.
Right.
I mean, I will help kids. The one thing I'll say is, okay, we have this agreement sort of, there's this kind of phrase, which is that 120 hours of study equals one Carnegie unit. Mm. You ever hear that?
Mm. No, I have not.
Okay.
No.
Okay. I mean, that's kind of a measuring piece so that if you're homeschooling mm-hmm. or creating your own transcript, let's say you danced or you were in a performance or something and you did 100 hours of rehearsal, you know, whatever, 20, you can give yourself credit with integrity by looking at how you use your time. So like this kid, these kids were working on Italian, you know? Well, 120 hours of Italian studying would equal a language credit in Italian.
Right.
You could certainly be studying in the course of 40, 50 weeks a year, a lot more than 120 hours. So it depends, you know. So one of the things I was saying to you that I think we've gotten better at, and also, you know, it's just being patient with us learning as we go, is that, you know, it's design thinking. You learn as you go. That's life. My son, I may have mentioned this last time, one of my sons works in a nonprofit in Boston. And when he first got out in the work world, he's just going to be 26 this month. He said, everybody's faking it. Everybody's right. Sort of faking it until, you know, we're all sort of figuring it out as we go. I mean, you want to have some expertise, obviously, you know, you want people to know how to do things, but especially if you're learning, it's a mystery, not a mystery, but I guess I am disappointed that I went to the superintendent when, you know, the week after the COVID, and I said, it's a really good time for us to be creative. And we actually invited me back a few months ago. I must've been like November to a think tank meeting with some of his people, like curriculum leaders and a couple elementary school principals. Mm-hmm. High school people won't talk to me. High school people don't, they're very intimidated by what we're doing because it makes them kind of unnecessary.
Teachers, you mean, or administrators?
Both.
Or both?
Yeah. Or mostly administrators.
I would think so. Yeah, sure.
Mostly administrators. But I was part of this discussion where Bill led the group and we just talked about, let's dream about possibilities, you know? And that's the thing that most all teachers I know, they want what we want for kids, yeah. But they're just, you know, listen, they're making good money. They have health insurance. I did it. I collected, put up and shut up, you know? And it's, power and control and money, and we've got to, you know, measure and organize.
And exposure. One of the, you know, I realized this in like 5 years, not even in a public school, right? Of like, you go in and the world is wide open, right? And you're optimistic. Yeah. And then the more time you spend there, and you could, I think anybody can remember the experience of being in middle school or high school and having a teacher who's 32 versus having a teacher who's 67.
Yep.
Right. The longer you're in there, the more that kind of reality tunnel, that spectrum mm-hmm. of possibilities, it just narrows and narrows and narrows until there could only seem to be one way to do a thing. And it also depends on, you know, how invested you are for other reasons. Right. Yeah. I think it's, a tricky kind of conversation to have with people who are more entrenched, either just yeah. through time or through responsibility, like a superintendent or an administrator, or, you know, somebody, the existence, you know, how much has the public school administration, like how much has that bureaucracy expanded since I was in first grade? 600%, 700%.
Oh my God. And why do we need all these analytics? You know, I'm all for analytics, but you know what? We're hyper analytic. Like mm-hmm. I don't need to measure. We just need to like do it and then let the, you know, results will rise and be apparent.
Well, I mean, I think it just comes down to bean counting. And if you look at things right. like all of these, you know, Common Core, No Child Left Behind, yeah. Goals 2000, everything that's been rolled out in the name of outcomes-based education. And, you know, all these parents are sending their kids into these schools without even knowing what outcomes-based education is. And that is a very much a standardization in multiple forms of the U.S. population at the most formative times in their lives. And also mm-hmm. to basically let corporations and other, you know, non-governmental interests order what they want this yeah. taxpayer-funded institution to produce for them. You know, corporations say, well, we're going to outsource to, you know, to increase bottom lines, we're going to outsource the higher level stuff to Southeast Asia. Right. So give us like service, give us people who don't know how to do math so they can be happy working in the service industry. Now, I'm hyperbolizing a little bit.
I know, but it's you're not too far off.
And that was the case with every single one of these rollouts that were about revolutionizing education for families and children, you know, since I graduated from high school. So that takes us back to like Goals 2000.
And that's the piece where shifting from sorting and competing, like the competition piece. If that's what you need in order to get yourself going, you can find people to compete with. But
yeah,
to force competition, I just learned recently that a friend of mine, their granddaughter flunked kindergarten.
Yeah.
How do you freaking flunk kindergarten? Like what? We've lost our minds. So I've been concerned with the teacher training that also in the last like 10 to 20 years, I know that some of the younger teachers coming out were completely opposite of me in the sense that they were very... Because they'd been trained, like, well, what standard would this be? You know, like,
yeah.
oh, if we teach that. And I'm thinking, no, wait a minute. You know, because what the standards movement has done, unfortunately, is it's actually sucked the life out of teachers, because now they're like, they're tentative, like they're questioning, oh my God, am I meeting this external thing rather than teaching what I know and love and share and went to school for and have done,
right?
Like teaching as a craft instead of teaching as a, you know, being paranoid.
And they're being broken by that system that does not instill independence, yeah, or confidence. So, you know, 20 years ago when they're rolling out No Child Left Behind, I'm told that I'm in graduate school, but I actually find out I'm in this group therapy session for new teachers, right? Working in the states of Massachusetts and, yep, New York, who have, you know, were really standards oriented already with the Regents and the MCAS. And all it is like whatever content was supposed to be delivered in these classes, just from the best I can remember, you know, we're talking like 2003, 2002. It's just these people going, I can't believe this is what I signed up for. I can't believe somebody walks, right, into my classroom and says, write the state standard that you're covering right now in chalk on the chalkboard. We had chalkboards back then.
Oh, no. And so you talk about insulting your soul, right?
Yes,
like,
exactly.
That's why I'm saying these kids are saying to me, I can't wait for you to read Morgan's testimony, because he speaks to this. Yeah, the also the sort of talking down to students, the power over students. Like, that's just bad form. It doesn't make for good humans.
And what the environment engenders, so much of that. It just seems, right, like the natural course of things, the way the system functions, the whole setting.
So how is it going to shift? I mean, I don't know. Like, how we you know a lot. You're a smart person. We know a lot of smart people. Like, and maybe it's not. I guess it is just sort of that we just keep pushing forward in our own ways, and it does connect. I mean, the one thing COVID has done for self-directed learning centers is we're not as weird as probably we were a year ago.
My kind of black-pilled is okay, sort of a hopeless, but I'm not hopeless, but okay. I'm going to say a black-pilled sounding thing, which is the U.S. public school system will exist until the day the U.S. government collapses. Because of its utility,
yeah,
and because of interests that are vested into it. My socio-political advice since the beginning of my show is don't be under the shadow of things that are collapsing, right? So whether that's, you know, any the institution of public school, an entire government, and they've all the ones in history eventually came down. And, you know, ours has some pretty dire warning signs. So that's one of the reasons why I would encourage people to just expand freedom and autonomy in as many areas of their lives as they can, in their health, in their finances, in their relationships, in their location, yeah, in their education. All of these things are places where people can just do this analysis. They can do this inventory of, like, here's where I'm at, mm-hmm, as far as freedom and autonomy in this area. How can I increase it by 1%, 5%, you know, and then set the metric that you want to sound like I'm writing an IEP.
But it makes sense.
Yeah. How can I get more?
And I have seen schools flex in the last 3.5 years around here. I mean, we in New Hampshire, they have extended learning opportunities. We've, mm-hmm, done a little bit with that with some kids. But more than anything, we've had schools through the IEP process or through maybe the 504, where some of our kids still do some sort of traditional school because that makes their parents feel better.
Yeah.
You know, like part-time online school. We have a couple of kids who do that through their district. So what I think, I'm hoping can happen, we keep using the phrase community resource. Like, Big Fish is a community resource, just like a lot of other nonprofits in the area. We're a community,
sure,
resource.
Yeah.
And so what schools need to get used to saying is, wow, this kid has been shut down for how long? Like, maybe we need to tap into a community resource. Maybe, yeah, we could pay Big Fish a whopping $9,000, which my CPA brother keeps saying to me, why haven't you raised your price in 3 years? It's because we have most of our people can't even come up with $9,000. And we have given over 50 grand a year in tuition waiver,
mm-hmm, yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So we'll get more savvy at that. But the idea is we need to encourage families to try these things, to know that it's okay to leave school if it's not working. If your kid is, you know, apathetic, dead inside, yeah, try something different. Get your kid out. And
absolutely.
And also the because it's the parents, and unfortunately, by the time a lot of these parents get momentum, then their kids are okay, and then they're just like, I'm so freaking tired of dealing with school. Someone else can fix it, right?
Yeah.
So it's sort of like the parents. We those of us who work with kids and, you know, care about this issue, we just need to encourage them to ask and demand that their schools meet the needs of their kids. Like, and it's not to say that it's boutique. It's not that. It's called life. Like, it's called like,
well, it's back to the theater then, right? Where this is a PTA meeting or this is a school board meeting, and this is where people go and give their input. And, you know, that was a nice story to tell 30 or 40 years ago. And I think with the asking that, you know, when you say demand and ask, it comes from what you're actually doing, which is like in the real world, you've put an alternative, you know? And now, like, maybe that's not a hard demand. Maybe that's not a picket line, right? But right. it is, here's something that exists. And then as this expands and it's Acton and it's Sudbury and it's all these other things, it is becoming more of a kind of pressure applied right. to this system, right? Right. And that is it, instead of
all we can do.
Yeah, the role play of like, I'm a parent who I don't want my kid reading Catcher in the Rye or whatever, you know, performances are that never really change anything. Like putting something into reality that applies that pressure, I think is the best approach to take. And it's helping people, more and more people, get out from under the shadow. And those are, regardless of politics, those are my allies.
Yeah. I mean, we're doing work that we're both doing work that is meaningful to us. And I am very lucky and I'm very glad for that. It has, like I said, I feel like I've grown up. You know, I had this, Ken Robinson used to say, it infantilizes kids. I think it infantilizes adults too.
Yes.
Obviously.
Yes.
And if you ever just go to like an assembly or watch teachers who can't stay in their classrooms because they act like children and they're constantly in their own diversion or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. I have recognized that in myself as, last summer I signed up back to therapy. It had been a while, you know, and like, whoa, what's going on? And I realized that my own executive functioning skills really needed some fine tuning. Like I really need to take responsibility for, you know, being more regular with certain things or just not being afraid to like, you know, I mean, run a fundraiser or, you know, put myself out there. And that was part of me contacting you was to do another interview was when you're new at something and then you're not feeling confident. And of course I said, big fish almost tanked a few times, you know, we'd be in board meetings and be like, oh, we have enough money to make it through October, you know, whatever. Confidence is huge too. So like, you know, even you can, that translates to kids, but I definitely feel like once we can get past COVID, you know, and again, it could be a bit of a longer road here. What we're doing is really good work and really kind of fun.
Well, I really appreciate it. And just to reiterate, like putting that into doing all of the novel work of putting something like Big Fish into the world as a kind of beacon, right? And as a kind of example is always the kind of thing that I'm so happy to promote and amplify however I can. So we'll do it again.
We'll do it again. And then when you're in New Hampshire, you need to come visit us. Come up and visit. You still have family up here, don't you?
I certainly do. All over that area. That's where I grew up.
So. That's what I thought. I actually know someone who used to date you, but we'll talk about that another time.
Well, interesting.
All right, cool. Brett, you're awesome. Keep going. Keep doing the good work. And check out our website. It's we have some really cool kids and cool adults. Just people trying to help people be better people.
And the website is, real quick?
Yes, bigfishnh.org.
Awesome. Yeah.
And I'm starting a podcast with a board member.
One of the things we talked about before was your kids were interested in podcasting.
Oh, right.
At the school. So I just want to make myself available. If that is still ever a future interest or an ongoing interest,
right.
I would love to do a chat with them.
All anytime. Right. Well, I may need to pick your brain with a phone call too. When my board member first presented it to me, I was just like, I have the bandwidth. But then, like I said, over the last month, I'm like, nope, you know what? I do need to put myself out there. Well, I've been at the top of a cliff and see ships go sailing away. And I've watched the sea.